I think we all understand the significance of democracy. Hey, table six, listen up. Mayor Brown. We're talking here about democracy in a consumer society. It's a consumer society within which we try to carry on this vast and noble experiment passed down to us by our veterans and the heroes who fought and died for our ability to vote, for the founders who came up with things like federalism and separation of powers, Bill of Rights and structural federalism. It's always been a challenge. It has never been easy. One of my first political memories, believe it or not, was watching the Huey Long movie, the incredible Robert Penn Warren's book turned into, help me, All the King's Men. And who remembers Broderick Crawford standing there one day before he ever got elected to anything with a stack of papers that he had had printed, and he had some kids in Louisiana handing these papers out, and the kids were getting beaten up. And he said, I just want my flyers to get out. It's a scene that is so much like what we see today. And if you're running for alderman in the city of Chicago, president, trustee at the College of DuPage, state rep, I just want my flyers to get out. Where are they going to get out? Who's going to read them? What are they going to say? For Robert Penn Warren, Huey Long, all the King's Men, they were sheets of paper. And now they're a bunch of ones and zeros. They're a bunch of electrons. They're the result of illuminating those diodes. How do we get all of this to make sense, not just for the candidates and the causes, but for the voters and the taxpayers? Here's the guy who will answer that question, Dan X. O'Neill. Dan, come on up. Dan came to us with this idea, and he now is going to introduce our illustrious panel. Dan, take it away.
We'll see you in a minute with questions.
You've deeply oversold everything. All right, we might as well, go ahead, come on, Betsy and Harper and Aaron and Chip, come on up and let's do this thing. All right, so thank you, Chris, and the City Club, Jay and Tweed and everybody that organizes these august lunches. Really happy to be here. I think you're going to dig this. Most importantly, we're going to have fun. All right, so let's introduce, just get right to it and introduce our friends who are going to be here today. So Betsy Hoover. Yeah. Betsy is a founding partner with 270 Strategies, leading the firm's digital strategy practice. She helped launch the company after serving as director of digital organizing for an outfit called 2012 Obama for America. Thanks for that. Betsy got her start as an organizer in 2007 and transitioned to digital in 2010. At 270, she focuses on women's economic and health issues, technology for engagement, voter empowerment, and electoral campaigns. She's passionate about building communities online and around issues that people care about. Also worth mentioning is the debut, at least as far as I know, of Isaac, baby Isaac. Is that correct? Baby Isaac's over here. So that's pretty cool. Next, we have someone by the name of Harper Reed. Harper's a hacker engineer who builds paradigm-shifting tech and leads others to do the same. Loves using the vastness of the internet and bring people together, whether as CTO for Obama for America, CTO at Threadless, or on his own individual projects through acquisition of his company, Modest. Harper is now helping define the future of commerce at a company called PayPal. All right. Next up, we have Aaron Ginn.
What's up, Aaron?
Ginn. Say that again.
Ginn.
Boy, I messed that up. Aaron Ginn. Aaron's co-founder of the Lincoln Initiative, which is a community of like-minded technologists that desires to advance liberty in the public square through the use of technology. He's worked in a multitude of technology-related positions in startups, government, and campaigns, including as a growth hacker for Romney for President in 2012. So welcome, Aaron. We have also Chip Englander. Chip has managed campaigns for president, governor, and Congress. He's got an extensive background in polling and modeling and in using the latest technology to advance campaign and corporate interests. He's currently serving as the senior advisor in Michael Best Strategies, a government relations firm with offices in Chicago, Washington, D.C., and around the country. All right, so those are the formalities. We've got everybody introduced, so let's get going. I thought that basically what we do is just go down the line in a very typical fashion and hear what you have to say about our prompt for today, which is political technology in the 2016 elections. Can you kick us off, Betsy?
Absolutely. Thanks, Dan, and thanks, everyone, for coming. It's great to be here with all of you. Like most of us in this room, I have a love-hate relationship with politics. I just happen to spend a little more time on it than most, since it's a lot of my day job. But the reason that I've spent as much time as I have in my career on political technology with Harper and others is because our challenge in politics, and really the opportunity in politics, is we have this moment every 2 years, every 4 years, of intense civic engagement. Some the highest levels of civic engagement that we see in our society today. And our challenge as people running campaigns, as candidates, and as active citizens, is to engage people in that moment. And for me, as an organizer, that means meeting people where they are. What we've seen over the past couple cycles is meeting people where they are is different than it used to be. It's not only something that happens in barbershops and beauty salons and people's communities, in churches, and in school parking lots. It is still all of those places, but it's also online. And that offers a whole new set of opportunities around political engagement and really what that means. And so when we talk about political technology, what we're really talking about is political engagement. And the tools that we use to do that well. And so for me, that's a whole area of opportunity. It's a really exciting area and actually an area of great responsibility when we think about civic engagement today. And so when we think about political technology in 2016, we've seen a lot of different campaigns on all different levels, but definitely at the top of our national ticket, using technology in really new, different innovative ways. And for us, that means not just what tools you can see, what interfaces you're interacting with, although the apps and organizing platforms and donation experiences that we're seeing are blazing new trails and breaking barriers, but also how we're using data in a smart way, how we're building models and targeting voters in a smart way, how our advertising is changing, and what that means, what opportunities that offers in terms of the way money in politics is structured, and how everyday voters learn about our candidates and learn about their choices in this election. And so I'm really excited about this conversation because it offers us the opportunity to dive into all those things. So excited to do that with you all.
Hello, everyone. I'm Harper. I think I come at this from a probably a drastically different perspective than most of the people on this wonderful panel. And I've learned a lot from a fair number of them, although I just met Chip, so hopefully I'll learn a little bit from you today. I come at this from the view of a technologist, as someone who spent a lot of time in startups and small businesses and some big businesses. And oftentimes in those companies, in kind of a startup world or in a technology world, the technology is one of the main reasons for what you're doing. You're trying to build technology to solve a problem. One of the things that, you know, Betsy in 2012, and I see Jeremy Bird over here as well, taught me a lot, is that actually technology is not the solution for many of these problems. It's only a small enabler. It's a lot about how do you connect people and how do you make that go a little faster, a little bit more efficient. But oftentimes when we think about, you know, what is the technology, we just expect to talk about programming computers, we talk about, you know, mobile phones, we talk about all these things that are actually just these tactical things. And actually, I think that's the boring conversation about technology. The exciting conversation about technology is a little bit what Betsy just talked about. And so hopefully we can learn a bunch more from that. And that's about it. I'm probably just going to listen. That's actually a lie. I can't. I love hearing myself talk. So, and I also have to admit that I don't have a blazer. So I'm sorry to all the other men in the room.
Totally modest. So I come from the same or similar perspective as Harper. My background's in Silicon Valley. We're actually both from the fashion tech world. Just on the other side of the
aisle. As you can tell.
I'm particularly interested. I was primarily interested in campaign tech now, but I think now it's sort of reaching a point where it's become more commonplace. So like Lincoln RC3 is actually focused more on like how technology is transforming society and policy. So we, you know, the most sort of well-known example is Uber, how Uber basically transformed the way we travel and transportation. It's also changing policy. It completely disrupted the union. In 5 years, right, versus all the think tanks, et cetera, that are actually working on that particular area didn't make sort of any traction. So I'm really interested in technology from that perspective. I think with this cycle, I think we've seen the versus like 2012 where technology was more of this like add-on to something that was used to like enable everybody else. We're seeing now the technology is like kind of more the core of where people are operating from. And I would say actually one campaign is particularly strong in technology. The other one is more, they're not very good at technology, but he actually represents, I think, the values of a lot of perspectives of the internet. He's basically made for a meme generator, right? And he's made for, the way he speaks, the way he talks is basically the internet. Like that's how people on the internet discuss things. And I think that's really fascinating from a policy and political standpoint of like he's sort of blaze a different path. If you actually look at what they do on a campaign basis, it probably is a regression from 2012, at least on the Republican side. Which is very interesting because, like, you know, I think that more on the Democratic side, they actually created a very strong institution. They hired like really amazing people out of the Valley, and it was like a very diligent, structured plan. Versus on the other side, it was like, hey, it was just like, get on the plane and see where it goes. Maybe we'll crash, maybe we'll fly. Like, we don't know, right? And I think that's a very interesting place to be if you care about this stuff, because the presidential nominee of the Republican Party has openly said he doesn't really care about these things, let alone that the RNC, which actually went on a project to build out infrastructure, which then actually, if you know the story of it, they built it, then they shut it down. And that is now actually the core technology operation of the GOP candidate, which is really fascinating because everyone hated it like a year ago, and now like that's the only thing that's actually keeping the campaign moving forward. So I think from like campaign tech standpoint, I think it is interesting just regarding the two individual candidates. I think as like a whole, the campaign technology world, I think it's now much more integrated into the philosophy of many campaign managers and general consultants. And like we're seeing, it's more of a regular basis. People talk about testing different donation platforms, A/B testing, different landing pages, messaging, emails, using new technologies. So I'm not sure like what new breakthrough innovation is going to come like what y'all worked on. Now that it's like sort of at, if you look at like way technology is adopted, it's more of getting towards the maturity standpoint, which is just means just more commonplace until there's like a next like bridge up. But I do see if Lincoln has like a great view across all the nation because of just our organization and like who we work with. And the really interesting things that are happening is actually more behind the scenes, like way back end of like figuring out what people really care about and how to reach them in different ways. That's the innovation that I'm seeing this year of taking different data sets, combining them together, finding new ways of engaging people that's not through someone knocking on the door or someone or sending an email. So, that's what I'm seeing.
So I come at it from a very different perspective from the other three folks, because my background is not in technology. I'm not a hacker or a software engineer. I'm a political operative, and I run political campaigns around the country. And I believe that campaigns, I'm sure we have a lot of Theo Epstein fans in here and maybe even a Billy Bean fan or two. You know, we're entering a Moneyball phase where technology is transforming how campaigns are run, and we're still in a period of a culture clash between you have very tech-savvy individuals like these panelists having entered into the campaign workspace, and they come into conflict with old-school operatives who don't really know anything about technology. And the operatives tend to come at it from one of two places. They either think it's all baloney, and they just want to silo the tech aspects of the campaign and don't let it get into the DNA of the campaign, or they think it's super important secret sauce that they don't really understand, that they know it's important to do, but they don't really know how to work it in. And I sort of sit at this crossroads because my background is someone who's run political campaigns, but I've also, I'm a pollster, and using data to drive all the decisions of a campaign, and that's sort of where the future lies in this space. You know, political campaign, there's three elements to a political campaign. There's message, money, and voter contact. And if you think of it as like a car, building the car, that's building your organization, that's the voter contact. Where you drive the car is the message, and money is the gas. And a winning campaign combines those three elements. And technology shouldn't be a standalone topic, per se, for a panel. Technology has to be part of all three of those elements. Technology is what's transforming sort of money in politics. You take a look at over the last five presidential races, every time there's been somebody who is sort of underfunded and dismissed who's become real because of the money they're able to do, you know, online fundraising, things like that, whether it's Bernie Sanders this cycle, whether it was Barack Obama, whether it was Howard Dean, whether it was John McCain in 2000, which was the first campaign to ever receive more money online than in person. Then you've got, you know, what Betsy was referring to in terms of, you know, you think of voter contact, the pinpoint precision. I mean, the old school way of doing things, broadcast television, which goes to everybody, we now have this ability to target our voter contact, to pick the individual and put the message we want in front of them. And so it's funny, you know, as a sort of a student of campaigns, what's sort of old is new. You're seeing this sort of, I think where we're slowly heading is a move back to sort of targeting and away from just sort of global broadcast messaging. And then the third piece, which was touched on, is sort of the modeling on the messages. So now we're getting the ability to deliver our messages to whoever we want, but we also have an ability to know what message do they want to hear. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who do sales in this room. I mean, how do you sell something, right? You tell people what they want to hear. And now we're getting the ability to know what the individual wants to hear and to put the message they want to hear only in front of that individual. And so the great conflict in campaign, obviously technology is going through a revolution. The tools that campaigns have today are much more advanced than they were, you know, 5 years ago. Right? I mean, it's like a complete transformation. It will be transformationally different 5 years from now. I think the great challenge for political campaigns, corporate interests, anybody who needs to move public opinion is going to be less what's the next great advance and more how do we make sure all these tools that are available are really being appropriately integrated in all the things that we do. Because sometimes there can be, you know, you've got folks who are quarterbacking these things who do not come from a technology background, and how do folks be brought along in this process so that they know how to use it? And the last piece is that technology, it can be the sort of the great democratizer in these elections, because you have the ability to raise money at this mass scale from grassroots people. You have the ability to not need to be on, you know, decreasingly you do not need to be on, you know, the primetime ABC most expensive show, right? You can increasingly, you know, you've got all these different mediums, whether it's, you know, Facebook, Twitter, pre-roll digital, all these different things which are much less expensive in that grand scheme of things. So you've got this ability for it to be a total leveler in things. But the great challenge to it isn't, I think, is less the tools. It's sort of what Aaron just said, which is, you know, this campaign, this presidential campaign, would have been a really interesting test study if it was closer, because you had one campaign that was trying to use all the available tools, Hillary, and then you have another campaign that's like, yeah, I don't believe in any of that stuff. It's just, you know, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to say my stuff. And if it was a close race, I mean, it would be an interesting test case. You know, instead he's sort of imploding. So we'll have to table this to 2020 probably. But so I think there is a total transformation which is sort of relevant to our daily lives that technology is bringing.
Anything? Okay. Awesome. It was a great kicker offer. We do have questions that are being sent around, right? We'll get to that pretty soon. What's that? On the blue. You got the blue? Everybody's working on your questions? Okay, good. We'll collect those as we go along. I wanted to go down and give an opportunity again down the line. I have some questions. Betsy, I love your focus on, you know, actual human engagement and the role of humans and their opportunities that every
What are humans?
Humans. Are you making fun? I don't understand the question.
I just...
Is it about my pronunciation?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Humans. I'm from Pittsburgh. Anyway. Humans by the Radiator. With regard to humans, we're going to go back to humans. users, right, users, people.
No, I think humans probably is better than users.
The opportunity, Betsy, for, you know, to have engagement with the political process. Do you have any examples in, you know, and again, it's the, obviously we're at a spot in time where it's the presidential election that's really hot. But any examples of technology in the current cycle that really is trying to deeply engage with people at that civic level, not just the contact level, not just the convince level, but at the civic level? What kind of trends or what kind of pieces of technology are you digging out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of examples, and I think what Chip said about the importance of technology really being it's not its own. Sometimes in campaigns we set up like the technology department or the digital department, which is like this group of weirdos that sit over there. That was Harper and I. But what we're actually seeing is that technology is the way that people experience campaigns, right, or the way people experience the political process in a lot of cases. And so the importance of that technology really being the foundation underneath all different parts of any campaign, that's when you've actually achieved the level of integration and the level of sophistication that's possible. And that is much easier said than done. And very few campaigns are doing that. So when we talk about, you know, where in the 2016 cycle are we seeing technology play a role, I think there's a couple really interesting places. On the Democratic side, the data and targeting team is taking even what we did in 2012 to the next level in terms of real-time data, how that drives voter contact, what voters you're talking to, and what messages you're using with them to make sure that you're addressing issues that those voters care about. That's an area that I really think we've just scratched the surface on. That there were growing in 2016, and I think we'll see further growth in cycles to come in terms of what's possible there. So that area, when we talk about voters, I think it's really about targeting and messaging where we're seeing the most innovation. The other place when we talk about civic engagement on a, like not just go vote on X day, the other place that we're seeing that and campaigns see that generally is with their volunteer base. So you have, you know, everyone in America is expected to vote. The people who spend the most time with campaigns are these volunteers who say, I want to donate my time. I want to spend my free time, you know, working to get out the vote, working to spread the message, working to make change in my community. And there we've seen tons of innovation in this cycle and technology take even another leap forward from what we've seen in the past. The two things I would point to, one, the Clinton campaign is doing a great job with mobile. They're taking mobile to the next level, both in terms of mobile first on cross platforms, but also they have a couple great volunteer engagement apps that I think they've used in a really smart way. So that's something to look at. And then the second thing is the role of text messaging in this campaign, which text messaging has been around for a while, but there's a couple of new platforms, either new companies or proprietary platforms of the campaigns that are using text messages in really real ways, and the ability that that gives organizers to be a force multiplier in terms of the number of people they're able to talk to on their phone, where they have 100% open rate as opposed to email, where you see under 15% open rate, under 10% open rate, is really amazing. And so those are the, you know, there's the messaging and targeting side, and then mobile and text messaging are the areas I'd look at for the cycle.
Awesome. Anything else? Anybody have anything to add on it?
There's nothing to report from the Republican Party.
I have no comment there. No comment.
Got that checked off. Thanks, Aaron.
We have a lot of questions, which is awesome. That's good. Could be rare around here.
That was mean.
I've got one here. Chip, it's from Mel Smith. Thanks for the question, Mel. Do you believe that debates will go away since they are so generic and not focused? That's the question from Mel.
No, I don't think debates will. Can you hear me? I don't think the debates will go away because there's huge viewership and I think there's big appetite for them, and they still cause movement in the polls. I mean, whether this cycle or in previous cycles, I mean, you do see movement in the polls after these debates. So no, I don't think they are going to go away.
I agree. I think that one is that the networks make a ton of money off of them. So why would they're incredibly incentivized to actually have it, let alone this election has broken a ton of records for both primary and for presidential. And I think that because of the path that's been burned with Donald Trump, that you're going to see more people like that who are going to come to make, basically, they come to the debate to control the media narrative rather than actually discuss what's actually going on. It's kind of like his strategy. And you actually kind of look at the whole race. He actually has kind of defined the whole discussion of the entire race. And so much so that Hillary is like responding to him now rather than like sort of burning her own path, which is really interesting. If you just look at the discussion post-debate and you look at like the word, what's it called? Like the word bubbles. Yeah. So you can see like word bubbles of like what CNN and Fox News and like all of them, they basically are all oriented around what Trump says, because he says, all he does is he fish hooks, right? He just looks for those things, and he finds it, and then he reels it in, and then he like points it and he hits at it, right? And that's like his strategy. So I think that the media is like absolutely in love with this race, and I think that they are going to try to propel that again forward with upcoming elections.
Yeah, piggybacking on that, I was going to say is that, you know, it's funny. I came from a school where you were taught all press was not good press, and there is such a thing as bad, harmful press. And Trump's entire game plan seems to be designed around share a voice in the press. He's like, I'm going to let Hillary do $1 billion of paid advertising, and I'm going to do zero, but I'm going to have, you know, $1 billion worth of earned media advertising, and I don't care if it's bad. I'm going to, you know, he's fish hook. You know, I'm just going to throw, you know, you look at that Cinco de Mayo tweet, and, I mean, he knows that that's insane when he does it. And it's just, my wife, she is not an active, she's not on Twitter. She doesn't have a Twitter handle. I remember that day asking her, hey, did you hear about Trump sending a tweet? She's like, yeah, well, at the 5 o'clock local news. Yeah. I mean, that is a conscious strategy, which flies in the face of a lot of conventions. But that only can happen in sort of this sort of new era.
You know, just to add on to that, and going back to the question a little bit, I hope debates don't go away, though. I mean, if we take debate out of our political discourse, that's terrible, right? That regresses us backwards. I think the problem is the format we're using is so off, because what you're saying is right. It's driven by press and networks and money and views and you know, attention. And that's messed up. And actually, what technology allows us to do, this like citizen journalist type that kind of ethos, it allows us to change how debates work. And we see it a little bit, right? This question's coming from Facebook. This question's coming from Twitter. But that just scratches the surface in terms of, you know, we could have debates. We could reimagine the way that debates work to really engage people much more broadly and eliminate some of the big money, big network, ulterior motive, driving forces behind the campaign narrative and behind debates generally, and really go back to what they should be, which is how people learn about their candidates and their decision makers and how they're going to vote, which really matters in our country, or should.
We have 16 questions.
Okay. And we're going to roll.
One word answers? Is that the?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Let's see how it goes. Let's go rapid fire here. Brent Hoffman, and if I don't get your name or affiliation right, hit me up. Chicago Architecture Foundation. What is a meme? Examples, why is it important? My children call it a meme.
Meme.
I don't know if they're making fun of me. I think that's not. They don't say meme, but they want me to say meme. I think it's reverse psychology. What is a meme? And can you give an example? Hit it.
Oh, boy. So the problem with defining a meme is that we're not at MIT studying memes, which people certainly do, and those people have a very academic definition of it. But I think does anyone here know what an image macro is? That's the dumbest question I've ever asked. So on the internet, you see those pictures. How many of you are on Facebook? Okay, how many people aren't on Facebook? Okay, I like how that didn't add up to the whole room. just letting you know.
How many refuse to answer questions posed by Harper Reed?
Anyway, on Facebook, for those of you who don't go on Facebook, you're going to have to get a life sometime, so just join. But for those of you on Facebook, you know when you see that little square and it has a text on it, and it's just like the famous one from long ago was the cat. It just said, "Can I have a cheeseburger?" or some shit like that. Yeah. And you're just kind of like, that's really stupid, and you laugh, and you, of course, share it to your whole network in some way. Email, like, I feel like if you're older, it's via email. If you're younger, it's via something we've never heard of.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how it goes. And you just share these photos. That image is a meme. And honestly, the experience of sharing it also is a meme in itself as well. And so it's kind of like, I don't know what the word meme actually means, but it's a little bit this the experience as well as the actual like media that you're sharing. And so, for instance, if you look at a lot of Trump supporters or the Breitbart, a lot of that is generating memes that are going through the alt-right in a very strong way. If you look at the Clinton side, the campaign itself is specifically generating images that then also will be shared as memes. So memes are this thing that we are using on social media really aggressively. A lot of this came from very interesting parts of the internet, which is a whole nother panel. But we can talk about later, maybe. Someone else will talk about it. A lot of it came from just kind of regular, random, weirdo users on the internet, Dan's kids, and they just created a lot of things. But it's a lot about humor. It's a lot about trolling. There's a lot of aspects of negativity within some memes. I don't know if y'all know who Pepe is, but Pepe was recently said to be like a hate symbol. I think that's true. Like, this, it's not like a joke. I mean, but it's kind of funny, so it's really confusing. And I'm a pretty liberal person. I don't know if you could get that, but the thing is a lot of these things came up through kind of fun comedy internet, and now they're being attributed to like a lot of really anti-Semitism, a lot of really bad and terrible things, and so it's a really kind of confusing time for someone who likes to share things on the internet.
All right, let's keep rolling.
Just to give some examples, so after this last debate, like a couple memes that came out of was Donald Trump with the scream mask behind Hillary, like, because when he was like lurking behind, he was like,
that's right.
So that was a meme that came out. The fly was a meme that came out. And then what did he say? He said something to Hillary. There was some other comment, or like for the first debate, it was like Lester, right? That was like a meme. He kept doing this, right? So like those things, it's usually text on a photo, and people like change the text with the photo on it to like say different things. But it's like an emotional experience, it's usually making jests at some point.
Just the real pro tip here, if you're going to Google this or research this, look at Wikipedia first.
Yeah, it can get nasty
real dark
real fast. It can get dark. So let's not get dark. We're going to wait for Land's End to come out with that Ken Bone sweater again. and we'll get there. So, George Chung from Joyce Foundation. Question: given the Russian attempts to hack our elections, what do you think about the Department of Homeland Security's decision to designate our election administration, our decentralized election administration system, as, quote, critical infrastructure?
Seems smart.
Okay. Anybody else?
Well, I don't understand. So are they saying that they want to nationalize the electoral process? Is that what you're saying?
I'm unaware of the prompt.
So I'm opposed to that, fundamentally, yeah.
You would oppose?
I would oppose that, yeah.
I don't think that's what it...
My understanding is that's not what it's saying.
Yeah, perfect. I think it's just saying that... And I actually think it's really smart. Like, generally on the internet, privacy is a higher concern. Security is a higher concern, and we've got to be thinking about it no matter where you're building technology for what, right? PayPal needs to think about it.
Yep.
The DNC needs to think about it. The RNC needs to think about it. And anyone who has our credit card information needs to think about it, right? Like, everyone needs to think about it. And our technology around elections is terrible. Outdated. It's just terribly outdated. Everything about it is terrible. And so what I hear the government saying in this is it can't be terrible anymore because the stakes are too high and there's too much critical information out there. And so it's critical. So fix it. And I don't think they've made a statement.
Yeah,
about
that's what I was confused about. But we've had this example since like 2000, right? Where like people are looking at punch cards, right? And like,
how'd
is that
go?
A punch or not, right? Like, so.
Okay, excellent. Anything anybody else wants to add? Question from Linda, and I'm going to try to be faithful to the emphasis and not add any. With all of the high-tech models for use for polling, how can you explain the fact that no one or very few of the established pollsters were able to predict the rise of the Republican nominee who shall remain nameless?
I like that no one will say his name. This is my favorite thing. It's Voldemort.
I reject the premise of the question because the polls all had Trump winning from basically the very beginning through the whole way until he won the primary. So I think the polls were accurate. The pundits were wrong. And pundits will continue to be wrong, just like they're wrong in sports, politics, and everything else.
Going further. Okay.
Brexit?
Is that what you said? The polls were wrong about Brexit. Were they wrong about Brexit?
I think this is one of the reasons why like GOTV is so important, is because often
get out
like,
the vote.
Like get out like this is the thing that if there was one thing that was pounded into my head during the 2012 campaign, that voting matters. Weird, right? Like in an election that people need to vote. And I mean it really was, and Betsy was joking, you're welcome, but it really was true. Like I hired a team of people who had no idea how elections worked. Academically, we knew, but then we didn't know that you really have to convince Democrats to vote. Like, that's something that was surprising. And so, like, learning that and then seeing it, and then seeing all of my friends in the UK, 100% of them say, we didn't think it would pass, so we didn't vote. That's the concern. And it's interesting that I'm not, I obviously don't know this, but it's interesting to hear when people talk about what is a campaign doing to not make it seem like it's a sure win. Like, because you don't want to say, oh, this is great. And so, for instance, Donald Trump today tweeted about polls where he's winning in this drastic, insane way. And it's like, is that telling his people that they shouldn't vote because it's a sure win? You know, and the same thing that, you know, the Clinton side obviously wouldn't do that, you know, as much. So it's interesting to think about what is the message that you're putting out there and how does it, you know, about that polling and how does that affect the turnout?
Yeah, the one other thing I'd add to that when you're in, sure, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, but when you're building a model or when you're doing a poll, there's a bunch of factors that go into that, right? One is, who's the population that you think is going to vote? Like, who are those people? And if you're wrong about that, your polls are wrong, right? Your models are wrong. So first it's, who are the people you think are going to show up? And then it's, what are they going to do when they get there? And all of those things are assumptions based on a lot of data. And we're actually, both sides have been really good at getting really close to that. But if you're just a little bit off in terms of who's going to show up or what they're going to do when they get there, then you're, what you think the right answer is not the right answer, right? And so I think you're seeing that in some of these places where we've seen really extreme votes like Brexit. It's because, well, maybe we're modeling the wrong universe, or maybe we're a little off about what some of those people are going to do when they get there, and that's probably because it's so different than what we've had before. And that, to me, gets back to GOTV and the importance of that. We cannot take anything for granted, right? Because if your people who you know need to show up and vote your way don't do that, you lose. Yep. That's how you lose. And so that GOTV effort, making sure the people that you want to show up and vote your way, that really matters. It's really critical for campaigns.
Yeah, I think Betsy's right, which is your sample is going to determine your accuracy and your numbers. And, you know, I'll never forget in 2014, the day before the election, when Nate Silver comes out and says that Pat Quinn's going to win. And I'm a big Nate Silver fan. That's a real gut check because my polls had us winning. And he says we're going to lose. And then we win. I took an exit poll on election day that had Governor Rauner winning by 4 points. That's exactly what we won by. And the key is you're getting that sample and not just sort of outsourcing your campaign, you know, to other people's assumptions. And to the point of, so what are the assumptions you should make? I mean, that could be its own really, really boring panel. But my basic general bias is I think pollsters get in trouble when they put too many restraints on the sample. You look at Gallup. Gallup, I think, has gotten, you know, every presidential election that's been closer than 5 points wrong for the, you know, last 20 plus years, including they had Romney winning in 2012. And because they're like futzing with they're you know, have all these screeners and all these things, and do you know where your poll is? And it's like it's too out of control. I think you want a couple basic inputs that you fix, things like gender, that there is such a there, it's been, you know, demonstrative over time exactly what that's going to be. But after that, I think you just let it float. And I think another one of sort of the unfortunate things about this election, you know, the current president, you know, from a just a student of politics perspective, but one of the things I think was going to be interesting in this election until, you know, the campaign is sort of spiraling a little bit, maybe it'll retighten, maybe not, but is I think, you know, in my polling right now this year, very recently, you know, found that Obama had really, you know, which Harper sort of alluded to, but Obama had really maxed out the left coalition. They're not Hillary voters who didn't vote for Obama, right? I mean, there are lots of Hillary voters who are super enthusiastic for Hillary, and they were all people who voted for Obama. But there are people, Republicans, who did not vote for Romney or McCain. And this was sort of this big X factor. You look at these people who don't vote, but they're saying they're going to vote this time and vote for Trump. Is that a mirage? I mean, as campaign operatives, we're taught you don't talk to those people. That's a waste of your money. Yet here they were, you know, in my polls, they're trying to screen in. They're saying, no, I'm voting. I mean, do you believe that or not? Well, I mean, so maybe we'll see what happens over the next 4 weeks. But, you know, it's something I'm less optimistic we're going to see how that sort of plays out, that dynamic.
All right. Here's another panel altogether. Caroline Bielicki. Asks, with voter sunshine laws, can we find info on anyone's political and civic engagement. How do you see privacy concerns and technology going forward in light of that?
I'm guessing the question is alluding to the fact that because of McCain-Feingold and other acts that you're required to disclose political donations over $250, and at least in federal, I don't know, I mean, States are super different. Like Colorado, there's like, I think, little to no disclosure. And I don't know what it like is in Chicago, or sorry, Illinois. Probably not that transparent. Why would you say that, right? I live in California, it's just as bad. It does bring up interesting things about, like, it's my opinion, and this is one reason why, like, I'm on sort of the right side of the political spectrum, is that rich people will do whatever they want anyways. Like, you can pass all these laws, you can try to restrict people to do all these particular things. Rich people are going to get to do whatever the hell they want anyways. So, like, if your goal is to, like, impact them, it's, like, not going to work, right? Like McCain-Feingold just made it harder for people who are, like, normal to run for office and harder for smaller donor people to actually just get involved, or they just don't want to anymore. And it's moved money elsewhere, right? The money has moved now to C3s, right? The money's moved now to super PACs, or they're, you know, people just are going to use their dollars to impact the electoral process however they can. It is an interesting question when it does come to political donations that we sort of throw out the privacy concerns, especially since that we have now examples of people who have participated in by giving money to political candidates who have lost their jobs. And so, do we want to live in a society that supports that, right? I don't think those people would somehow not get involved politically anymore. You just may not know about it, right? So, like, maybe they'll, like, you know, give to a C3 instead, and that C3 is just super involved in some other state or in some other way. So it does bring up, like, I'm personally conflicted because I generally don't like all the money that's involved in politics. However, I do know from just what I do for a living that rich people get to do whatever they want anyways, and they'll be able to influence however they want to. And at the same time, like, I am seeing that there's, like, sort of a consolidation of power among political donors and political class that actually control a lot of the way elections move. Some people we know about, like, Soros, right, the scary left-winger. And then on the right, it's the Koch brothers, right, the scary right-wingers. And so there is this consolidation going on because I generally think people, they don't want that dirty laundry aired because we're in a society that now, because the internet, it's one of the bad things in the internet, that we have this, like, public shaming and hysteria that goes around. Some of it's completely legitimate. Some of it's, like, I think, dehumanizing and very disrespectful. But anyways, so.
We have a question from Jim Aldworth from the Chicago Fire Department. How do we have a thoughtful dialogue if I can filter out unwanted messages and my opponents can do the same? Is anyone neutral anymore?
I don't think anyone's neutral anymore.
I agree.
That's kind of where I stand on that. But I also think that the world that we have where we're able to live in a microcosm that agrees 100% with everything that I think is also bad. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not really sure how to solve this because there are a lot of solutions for this that we have. It's just people are unwilling to participate in them. And so I think I'm not really sure. I can continue talking, but I think it'll just get darker and darker and we'll all lose hope. So I'm just going to slowly back from the mic.
Well, you know what? So love to hear from you, Betsy. And there's actually another question from Angie Grover from Presence Health that hits on the same note. Like, how do you reconcile micro-targeting and creating community discourse around an issue? It seems that people are increasingly listening to what they want to hear at the expense of intelligent debate. What do you think of that?
Yeah, this does get a little bit to the prior question, too. And what I was going to bring up there was social media makes this complicated, right? Because of the algorithm on Facebook, because your Twitter feed shows who you're following, it's more and more likely that social media becomes an echo chamber, right? And you talk to your friends think like you hear what your friends are saying, which is what you're already thinking. And so then where's the civic debate in that? And I think that's a real challenge in terms of communication on issues generally, and definitely political communication and political engagement, that Facebook and Twitter have no incentive to solve, right? And so it gets to people who do care about civic engagement and civic discourse to try to break through that in different ways. And I don't think it's up to Facebook and Twitter to solve. I think it's up to citizens to say, where are we having this civic debate? And there's some places online that can happen, and there's some places offline, like rooms like this one. But how do we continue to further that? I don't think it's up to Facebook and Twitter to do. I think that the micro-targeting question, though, is important here, because if campaigns are targeting, they're not targeting their base, right? They're not calling the people who already agree with them. They're actually calling the people who are most likely to be persuaded by their message, who need to hear the message that their candidate has and probably isn't hearing it on their Facebook feed or in their Twitter timeline. And so that, to me, is actually an important place to do that, right? This undecided voter universe is a really interesting place for civic debate and civic discourse to happen. And so I think there's an interesting thing there, both about how that conversation happens with campaigns, but also how we can facilitate that among voters.
So a few thoughts on that. I'll try to be brief on every one of them. So the first is, the question is accurate, that the more sort of modeled and fine-tuned we can be and pinpoint precision, sort of the less robust and diverse the dialogue is going to be, because campaigns are going out there and telling people what they want to hear. But the second piece is that really I think the fault and challenge and all that isn't with the campaign. It's the fact that the consumers, the voters, want to hear the things that they agree with. I mean, in sales, bias confirmation is where you start. I mean, it's not an education campaign as much as it's, I mean, that's, so if we want to hear diverse things, or if we're split on issues, the data is going to show that too. And campaigns are going to, I mean, market forces are going to react to that. So, you know, technology is problematic there, but it's, you know, it's hand in hand with a different problem, which is on all of us. You know, on the question of are there any undecided voters, we're in a really, really weird place where I think on the one hand, right, there is sort of this disappearance, there's so much polarization. But on the other hand, there might be more sort of undecided people than ever before, because you have such anger and disgust at both parties. I mean, yeah, we're super polarized because we have these two choices. I mean, I wonder what Michael Bloomberg thinks when he thought, boy, I can only run as independent if it's Trump or Cruz and Bernie. You know, that might have been a miscalculation. I mean, Hillary might have been just fine. I mean, or Mark Cuban or some sort of other personality to run as independent who had the means to do it. This year could have been that year, and you might see more of that in the future. I mean, both parties are going through a transformation right now. The Democrat Party is becoming a socialist party. The Republican Party is becoming a populist party, and that acceleration, that those trends are accelerating.
I would say that in this election, the biggest loser will be the media. I think the media has rubbed itself, has just gotten in the mud, and is just rolling around it, and is just enjoying it. And it's sad, right? It's sad to see that, like, both sides have decided to just go all in for their particular candidate and advocate really heavily. And I don't know where – I think the media has been biased for, like, super long time, and I agree with Harper that, like, everyone has a perspective. But at least they, like, pretended to be, oh, we're objective, right? Now it's just, like, no one even cares. They're all in it, and – I'm very concerned about where we go as a nation, where we don't have the ability to actually understand and articulate each other's arguments accurately and appreciate where other people are actually trying to come from. And in the 90s, at least, there's still some shows. In 2000, there's still some shows. Now it's just like you either watch Rachel Maddow or you watch Sean Hannity, and that's it, right? There's like nothing really between. The Sunday shows, which I think are probably the most – Sunday morning shows are probably the most fair – most balanced. I mean, those are like super, they're not very popular, right? And you've seen attempts in the media to have these like sort of both sides, and the same, like, it's consumers, right? They don't want to read it. And so I agree with y'all that, like, it's a reflection of us. Politics is not, I do not believe politics actually sets culture. I believe we put culture into politics, and the politicians are just reflecting us because they want to win, right? I have a generally quite low view of most politicians. I'm hopeful they make the right decision. I'm not surprised when they don't, because ultimately their primary incentive is to be in office. And we are sending those people. So when people complain about Congress, I'm like, look at yourself, right? You put those people there, right? And there's actually even, I forgot the name of the effect. There's actually like a Wikipedia article about this effect that's been given of where people hate Congress so much, they think Congress sucks, but then they have approval rating of their congressman by like you know, their approval rating is like 90%. It's like, you send that person there, right? This is the people's house, right? This is your house. And you're sending the same person back who doesn't do anything, who just argues, you know, participates in some caucus that tries to self-destruct its own party, and, you know, goes out on TV and, like, you know, tries to jive people up to get on Fox News or wherever the hell.
I'm hearing a lot of pain, Aaron.
I'm actually quite even keeled.
The pain, but. We're going, so part of my pain is that I failed to get to every question. I'm sure you'll be here for the next couple hours, so come up, and if your question wasn't answered, demand that it be answered. And with that, I would thank our panelists for a wonderful, wonderful experience.